Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. Senator Betzel, you're first up on the list today, so welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two bills. I'd like to deal with the notary bill, Senate File 214 first, if that's the bill we have before us. And I have Tom Durand and individuals from the Secretary of State's office here. There was a group that of notaries, public, that spent about the better part of a year looking at the current laws on the requirements and the duties of notaries public, and they met from about the summer of 2007 until the spring of 08. You have a summarized copy of their findings and recommendations in your packet dated May 2008. I will walk you briefly through the bill. There is an author's amendment that I'd like to have offered at the conclusion of that. Basically, in Section 1's and also Section 6 of the bill deal with the payment of the fees. This just streamlines it and clarifies it, because right now part of the money that a notary pays goes to the county, part of it goes to the state, and it's just confusing in the statute, you know, where it's to be paid and who it goes to. We're not changing the allocation at all. This simply says that you're going to pay your $120 fee to the Secretary of State in order to get your notary commission, and then when you record it, you go to your local county and you pay $20 there. So the overall numbers isn't changing. We're just making it easier so that the counties can figure out who gets what money and so forth. But none of that has changed at all. But that's what Sections 1 and actually 6 do. Section 2 sets a maximum fee that the notary can collect. This actually was an issue we had in the previous biennial session of the legislature. Just some background here. In 1905, the legislature set the fee for most notary acts at 25 cents. There was one area where they could charge a dollar for a notary act. But otherwise, in 1905, they set it at 25 cents. It stayed 25 cents until 1983. And in 1983, we raised the maximum fee you can charge to a dollar. Now, you don't have to charge anything for a notary act, but if you're going to charge anything, you could charge up to $1. So we were actually in here, I guess, a year or two ago and had a bill that simply raised the maximum allowable fee, again, not a requirement, up to $5. Then the governor vetoed that bill, saying that this was a 500% increase from $1 to $5. This bill, as it's structured, does pretty much the same thing. This is what the notary publics came forward with, but I'm just alerting the committee that we've seen that issue before. But I think it's still reasonable because, again, a notary doesn't have to charge anything, but to the extent that they have to do certain things, and they have to pay for their commission and so forth, which used to be $20, and now they have to pay $120 for their commission, charging a little bit more for the act of notary if it's being done at all. Seems reasonable, but that's part of this bill. In Section 3 of the bill, this establishes the format that ex officio public officials have to follow, because there really isn't anything in the law right now delineating how we're supposed to notarize. For instance, legislators, by virtue of being a legislator, we have the right to notarize things. But we don't have anything as to how we're supposed to do it, or at least it isn't clear in the law. And actually, this also requires that if we're going to do it at all, we should have a stamp, which is what everybody else, all other notaries do. So that deals with the ex officio members. That's in Section 3. In Section 4, this deals with the situation where sometimes a notary will use a nickname or some other name which doesn't quite match up with the name that's on the notary's stamp. So it causes some confusion. You use a nickname when you sign it, but then the name on the stamp is a little bit different. So this just says whatever name's on the stamp is what you have to use when you're notarizing the document. It also Section 4 also says that we have notaries that have to notarize the fact that somebody's signing a document and the document itself is not in English. Of course, the notary isn't authenticating the contents of the document. All the notary does is saying that the person who signed it is the person whose name actually appears here. So the notary part must be in English, even if the rest of the document is not in English. That's also part of Section 4. Section 5 deals with the fact that currently in Minnesota law, we allow qualified people from counties that are bordering Minnesota to become notaries, and then they have to file their credentials in a Minnesota county. But it's only the counties that border Minnesota that are allowed to do that. This expands it to anybody in a bordering state, Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota, that can also be qualified as a notary in Minnesota, but then they also have to record their certificates, you know, in the counties within the state of Minnesota. But it's not just the bordering counties, it's the bordering states now. Section 6 gets back to the issue of the division of the fees that I talked about in Section 1. Section 7 requires that notaries do have to, when they apply for a commission, they would have to authorize a criminal background check. It's not just to say that the check is actually going to be done, but if the Commissioner of Commerce feels that a background check is appropriate, then this authorization will, you know, can be used to find out if the person should be qualified as a notary public in Minnesota. So they have to fill out the authorization, and then it's up to the Commerce Commission to decide whether to proceed on that. Section 8 just clarifies how long the commission is valid. It used to be it was valid for a couple of years after you had it. We've lined it up in recent years to say that they're all going to expire at the same time in January 31st. But it now it's more clear that it says a commission is going to be valid on the fifth year until January 31st, and the renewal period right now is only 2 months before the commission expires. This expands it to 6 months prior to the expiration, so we don't have all these applications for renewal coming in at the same time. So this just clarifies the period under which you can renew your commission. Section 9 deals more with the ex officio notaries and requires them to have a stamp. It also says that the journal and the stamp are the personal property of the notary, so that through garnishment or execution, those can't be taken away. Those actually do belong to the notary. Section 10 provides more specifications of the notary stamp, which, again, are not quite spelled out right now. This is a simplification of the process and also for the ex officios. In Section 11, this provides requirements for electronic seal because there are more and more documents right now that are electronically generated and some have to be notarized, so this ties into the electronic requirements. In Section 12 of the bill, this clarifies that in a county, you have to file your notary commission with the court administrator. But because in some areas of greater Minnesota, actually court administrators are being shared among counties, there may not be a court administrator in a particular county. So if they've delegated the court administrator's duties to another department, then you file it with whatever department it is. And this is also for out-of-state notaries as well, too. Section 13 sets up a process by which if somebody is notarizing a document and the person who's signing it is unable to sign or has difficulty communicating, this now sets out a process by which the notarization can take place, and the notary has to make certain statements as part of the notary to indicate, you know, who actually did sign for the person who was otherwise unable to write. Section 14 makes it clear that the commissioner that if somebody's commission is revoked, they have to send the stamp back into the Commissioner of Commerce. And Section 15 is repealing those fees that, as I say, would be raised under Section 2. Mr. Chair, that's a walk through the bill. Now, we do have the A1 amendment, and this is more technical than anything else. The A1 amendment simply, there's a lot of places that refer to a seal, especially for ex officio like legislators, and the direction of this bill is to actually have people use rubber stamps because that's what people generally use, or electronic certification. Very few people actually use seals to notarize things anymore. So this kind of clarifies that. So that's what the A1 amendment does. And with that, Mr. Chair, I see any questions. Tom Durand is here from the Secretary of State's office. And if I can just also call your attention, there were a couple of recommendations from the Notary Study Group that were not adopted. That's on the last page. requiring notaries to keep an official journal, requiring them to be bonded, requiring training and so forth. They met for a number of times, and most of the recommendations that you see within this bill are those that were recommended by that notary working group.
Thank you.
That is the bill.
Thank you, Senator Betzold. And let the record note that a quorum is present. Senator Prettner-Solin?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A1 amendment.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted.
For discussion.
Mr. Duran, would you like to make a few comments?
Mr. Chairman, Tom Duran, Secretary of State's Office, thank you. I think that findings and recommendations, you have a list of people who were involved with this, and you'll see that it comes from a wide variety of places, including Dean and counties and cities, and a variety of legislators and others. So we had a broad base of people looking at this from a variety of different angles to make sure that we were picking up on things. Now, the National Conference on Uniform Laws is also working on coming up with a new uniform law provision, so we did make recommendations to them on some things that we don't have in this bill. So we've tried to look to the future for what they might recommend back to the state of Minnesota in a few years on notary laws.
Mr. Chair, there's one bit of unfinished business that we need to take care of. On page 7, line 12, there's a blank where a fee needs to be inserted. These are for documents that a county certifies. They're usually being sent to foreign countries. This is a practice that's done right now, and it's my understanding the counties are just kind of all over the map. Some charge nothing, some charge a fee, but there is no set prescribed fee. Mr. Duran informs me that in polling the counties, they think a $5 fee would be appropriate here, but as I say, this is left blank because we didn't have a sense for what to do when this bill was being drafted. So that's something that has to be filled in at some point, hopefully in this committee.
Senator Vanderveer.
So what are they doing currently?
Mr. Duran?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, they currently do certify these documents for particular places overseas, and they have different types of certificates. This sets a standard certificate for them to authenticate the notary's signature, and they charge a fee for doing that. I think this would just set in statute the amount of that fee. So the county right now is setting the fee amongst other things that they charge their customers for.
So right now, Mr. Chair, they can charge whatever they want, and you're thinking of telling them maximum? Is that,
Mr.
Senator Betzold, what you want to do?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair, is that right now I don't believe there is anything that it says what the fee should be, and this establishes a fee. The counties are doing it right now, but we asked, you know, what the range was. We're not quite sure what it is, but this at least sets something down so we have consistency through the state.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do a similar process at the state for documents going overseas, and we charge $5, so that would be consistent with what the Secretary of State's office is charging.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about this section 4, that the notary's name must be identical to the signature. And I think of myself, who has this long name, Yvonne Prettner-Solin, and I essentially sign Y. Solin on everything. And there have been times when I've been required to sign the full Yvonne Prettner-Solin, but it's not really my signature. I can write it out, but it's not my signature, and I really object to it. And I'm just wondering why the name as it's printed and the signature that's signed to validate that can't be the signature that is carried through.
Mr. Duran?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I agree that's a problem, but it's equally a problem when you have a signature that doesn't match what the name of the person is. So I sort of the balance there.
Well, I would say,
Senator Prentice-Solin,
Mr. Chair, that my signature looks more like my name than many signatures I've seen, that you'd never be able to know whether or not it matched that signature or not. A signature is a signature. I'm not sure how you define that.
Well, and Mr. Chair, and I guess the Commerce Department would have to address this one, but it would seem to me that when you make the application, you can put the application in the name that you want to be on your notary commission. And if you wanted to say why Prentner-Solin, I suspect that you could submit it to say that that's the name that I want to use. It's just that then when you get your notary stamp, that's the name that appears on the stamp, and when you notarize somebody else's signature, you'd have to use the same thing so that everything is matching up. As I say, people use nicknames right now, which is different from the name that appears in the stamp, and it causes confusion whether this is a valid notary. Notarization, I guess, yeah.
Further discussion on the bill. Would anyone else like to testify in Senate File 214?
Mr. Chair, could we address
Senator Betzel.
Could we address the issue in Section 7 before we wrap up? As I say, $5 seems the right amount to me, but this bill would go from here to at least the Judiciary Committee. I'm not. It may also have to go to the Finance Committee because of the fee change as well, too. So it's got a few places to go beyond, after the stop here. So.
Senator Prentner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, I would move the $5 fee on line 7.12.
On the Prentner-Solin motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The oral amendment is adopted.
Make it where the senators can get $100 a pipe.
Then, you want to move the bill, Senator Prentner-Solin?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill as amended.
On to the Committee on Judiciary.
Yeah. As amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Senator Anderson is around or available. The other bill I've got is going to have some controversy to it, so I don't know how you desire to handle that. So.
I believe hers is going to be as well. So if you're willing to go ahead.
I'm willing to go ahead here.
Okay.
You should have a couple of this is Senate File 251, and you should have a couple of handouts that I provided to you. It may help if I just explain a little bit of history on this bill, Mr. Chair and members, because I was having trouble. This is going to tie your brain in knots, let me just tell you right now.
What do you call it?
It's going to do that. In 1945, the legislature passed some laws on traffic safety. And most of those stayed on the books until the no-fault law was passed in 1974. So you have in your document, in your handout, should be something that it says 2004 statutes, okay? This used to be what had been the Safe Responsibilities Act until it, and you can see all the repealers from 1974 because it was all changed. There was almost nothing left in Chapter 170 after no fault, and it just stayed on the books this way for 30 years with virtually nothing left in there. Then, and of all things, the Data Practices Bill in 2005, and you should have a one page there, on it is Chapter 163. At the very bottom, it says, Section 88, Instruction to Revisor. And that directs the revisor to renumber two sections of Section 170, 170.24 and 170.54. 54 is the operative. Just renumber them and to put them in Chapter 169. That's all that we did. That was all that was done there. Now, this was an issue that originated somewhere in the House. They put in the Data Practices Bill. The author doesn't remember why it was being done. But today, if you look at what's left of Chapter 170, and we got that, there's nothing in 170 anymore. because apparently somebody must have said, look, we've just got this chapter that's got nothing in it. Let's just close it out and move those two those sections somewhere else and move them into 169. So it was a renumbering thing. And that's where the problems start arising, because we've got litigation that comes out of that. And I've got a court case that I've provided to you called the V case. And what had happened was, after the legislature renumbered the section of 170, this section of section of 170 simply defined what a motor carrier, it says a driver is deemed to be the owner or agent, okay, of a motor vehicle. And it moved it over into a section of law that already defined what a vehicle is, and that's the traffic offenses section, section 169. I said this is going to tie your brain in knots, and it is, okay? So what wound up happening was we now have two different definitions in section 169, the old one that had always been there, and then the new one that was moved from 170, just renumbered and pushed into 169. And of course, there's an accident that happened. A motorcycle hit a trailer, and the issue was, is the trailer liable? And these are insurance issues, which is why it's in this committee. Is the trailer going to be liable for damages? Because is it actually a motor vehicle, or is it a vehicle? Because we've moved both definitions into 169. This court decided, and I'm looking at page 3 of the court decision, is that it says that the Minnesota Safety Act, which was done in 1945, that we repealed most of it in 1974 for no fault, and we had what was left in there defining motor vehicle was construed using the no fault laws. But now, since we moved the provision from 170 to 169, the court said the legislature must have had some reason to do it. Since we've got a definition of vehicle and motor vehicle, we are going to decide to go ahead, and I may be misstating this, and somebody can, please correct me if I'm wrong, but they said that we're going to assume that the old 170 definition should be read in light of what has already been in 169, which means that the owners of the trailer are not liable because we've already got a definition of what a vehicle is in 169. So it did change the liability views of who pays what just by renumbering it and moving it there. So, and other folks I know can testify as to what it is. Now, here's the problem. It'd be nice just to pull this section back out of 169 that we renumbered and put in there, and just take it out and leave the law revert in 169 exactly back the way it was before this renumbering was done. Unfortunately, just pulling it out doesn't help us because there's nowhere to send it to. Everybody agrees we need this section on the books, but you can't send it back to 170 because there's nothing left in 170 anymore. Everything's been repealed. There's no real place you can put it. I thought about, can you send it to the No Fault Act in Chapter 69 and so forth. What this bill, the bill before you, says in a nutshell is that it's the very same language, again, that used to be in Section 170. And the new sentences on lines 10 and 11 simply say, okay, for the purposes of this subdivision, when we talk about motor vehicle, which would be including the trailers, it has the meaning of the no-fault law back in 65B. Now, this is controversial, I understand, because some people believe that this should be done, and others say, no, this is going to involve stacking of insurance policies for that. So there's other folks, I think, who can testify as well, too, but I try to give you the lay of the land as to what it is, and I'll let Mr. Carlson take it from there.
Thank you, Senator Bitzel. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I actually got to do a little bit of legal research on this issue. I listened to every hour, painfully, of the 2005 Omnibus Data Practices Bill, and if you think Richie Neumeister is fun live, you should take about 5 hours on Memorex. It was quite an experience. But there, not a single word is mentioned in all of the legislative discussion about this renumbering. It came in a author's delete everything amendment in the House Civil Law Committee. It received no discussion. It was never introduced in the Senate. It was through the House and Senate floor debates, never discussed. And it was accepted by Senator Skoglund and Senator Betzold in the Omnibus Data Practices Conference Committee and adopted. And it is our belief, and Senator Betzold handed you the V case. I want to amplify just a little bit on what he said. It isn't so much that there is a new definition. When they renumbered Chapter 170 into 169, it changed the law because there is a definition of a motor vehicle in Chapter 169 that does not include a trailer. And in this case that Senator Betzold provided to you, the V case, the defendant or the trailer company brought a motion to dismiss out the claim against them because the legislature renumbered this. A trailer is no longer a motor vehicle under the definition in 169, even though since 1945 it always had been. But simply because of this renumbering, they were granted summary judgment and dismissed from the case simply because of that renumbering, with no substantive change to the law. And this issue was brought to my attention on behalf of the Association for Justice in August or September of 2008 after this district court decision came down. And we need to understand that the section that was moved does not deal with specifically insurance coverage. The Safety Responsibility Act deals with exclusively having people be financially responsible for their vehicles that are on the road. Coverage, even in this case that Senator Betzold gave you, if you go to page 8 of the case, questions of coverage are answered after a final judgment is entered. And that is what they found, particularly in trucking cases. And so this issue is not really about coverage. It is about the definition of a motor vehicle. And since 1945, a motor vehicle has always included the trailer. And a court case in 1992, finally getting around to that final interpretation because they didn't link up 170 with no fault when they changed it in 1974. But the Gala case in 1992 said, for the purposes of this section that we're now renumbering, we are going to use the definition of a motor vehicle found in the No-Fault Act. That's what we have been using. That's what we're going to use, and there has been no dispute about that at a minimum since 1992. And so what Senator Betzold's bill does is it says that for the purpose of this Safety Responsibility Act, we are going to use the definition of a motor vehicle, which we've been using since 1945, and I brought the law here if you want to look at it, a motor vehicle that includes the trailer, and that's the definition found in 65B, 43 subdivision 2. That's all this bill does. It puts it back in the place where it was prior to this renumbering that no one can remember. No one talked about. The House author, Mary Liz Holbrook, said, I didn't even know it was in there. What are you talking about? So clearly the legislature didn't intend for this substantive change. But the trucking company believes that regardless of that, that we didn't intend that, it's clear on its face that a motor vehicle in 169 does not include the trailer. And that's true. It doesn't. And that is the problem. It always did before. And if you're going to make that change, which is a policy decision for you to make, you should do it with some conscious effort and not in the memo that I gave you, and I think Senator Betzel referenced it as well, and not in section 88 of a 88 section bill, the very last section, which simply renumbers two sections. So this is not as controversial or as difficult as it seems. We are simply putting the definition back that was in place since 1945.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, before the numbering snafu and you had an independent tractor driver pulling somebody else's trailer, who carried the insurance?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scogin, both. And they both carry the insurance today. They both carry it, and federal law requires a motor carrier, including a trailer, to carry what is called an MCS 90 endorsement. And they have it then, and they have it now.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just, having listened to both explanations, I understand it's a matter of putting the law back in terms of the definition. But what we haven't heard is kind of why this matters. And it seems like, probably to put this in context, and I'm sure we're going to have other testimony, it would be good to hear what difference it makes and why this matters.
And that's why I said it's controversial, yes, Mr. Chair, Sarah Olson. So there are people who want to say why it matters, yes.
And
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Senator Olson, it matters because in some very catastrophic cases where there are significant injuries, as you sort out the damages, you may need to access, I'm not saying you'd have to, but you may need to access coverage. But that is a coverage issue. The question, and in this particular instance, where the truck and trailer ran over a motorcyclist, lost his leg, blind in one eye, very severe damages. And this motor vehicle, which both has insurance, may need to be accessed to pay the damages. So it does get to the issue of who is responsible jointly. And the Safety Responsibility Act specifically and unchanged since 1945 makes us responsible as owners and agents for the vehicles that we put on the road. And that vehicle includes and always has included the trailer until this simple renumbering.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, just to kind of put it down into its basic terms then, I think what you're saying is both the trailer and the truck are required to carry insurance under law, and the insurance is for the purpose of paying for potentially for liability that they would have if they were involved in an accident. But because of this renumbering thing, we kind of inadvertently made it so that the trailer gets kind of a free pass in terms of being able to access that insurance coverage?
In
the V case, when they were dismissed at summary judgment based on the trailer company's argument that this renumbering substantially changed the law so they can escape liability, yes, that is the outcome.
Mr. Carlson, didn't you say, and it goes back to Senator Scogin's question, I thought that you said under that MSC 90 endorsement that both the tractor and the trailer would be covered under insurance.
Only if they are a motor vehicle, Senator. And the problem is this definitional change says that they are no longer a motor vehicle. So, and they are no longer a party to the case because they have been dismissed because they are not a motor vehicle.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, and so I think if I can just kind of put that in simpler terms, what he's saying is, yes, they have to have insurance. They did before and they do now, but you just can't get at the insurance because they have to be defined as a motor vehicle in the No-Fault Act to be liable at all. And if they're not defined as a motor vehicle, you can't sue them. So it doesn't make sense. The two don't quite line up then.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Betzel. Who ran over the motorcyclist, the trailer or the tractor?
I,
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, for the purposes of their liability by a long line of cases, that issue is not even relevant. They are treated as one unit. The trailer can't operate independently, and so they are treated as one unit.
But who ran over, Mr. Chair?
Senator Betzel.
If you read the bottom, you know, the brief description of the case, it's at the bottom of page one, the start of page two. It's a personal injury case. A truck, semi-trailer truck was driven by the defendant. The motorcycle was by the plaintiff, V. And apparently the tractor was owned by one entity, the trailer by another. They probably both rolled over them, right. But they were both being sued, the tractor owner and the trailer. And it's the trailer owner that said, we're not liable because we're not defined as a motor vehicle. And so that's why the court threw them out, even though it was the same two sets of wheels or whatever that drove over this motorcyclist.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, they don't make a distinction between whether or not I'm only responsible because I was injured by the back tires of the trailer. They don't make a distinction there. And that is exactly what the Safety Responsibility Act of 1945 is all about. You are deemed an agent for the owner, and so you're jointly accountable for that, and that definition has always included a trailer, and now with this case, it doesn't.
Okay, let's hear from Ms. Backus and see what she has to say.
There may be somebody else. Let me get this out of here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Amber Backus, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association. It's a statewide organization representing motor carriers of all sizes and the vendors that serve the industry. Since introduction of this legislation, I've been inundated with inquiries from trucking insurers, intermodal companies, and transportation attorneys, lucky me, who have used this technical fix as having negative consequences for the trucking industry. In their opinion, bringing the motor vehicle definition from 65B directly into the section of law regarding tort liability could have the unintended consequence of treating a tractor and trailer, when used together, as two separate vehicles and allowing claims to be made against the liability insurance of both. This would be a deviation from current law before 2005. In the trucking industry today, oftentimes the motor carrier driving the truck is not the owner of the trailer with the load it is pulling. Other motor carriers, leasing companies, or the shipper themselves may be the owner of the trailer. And this is the point I want to underscore. They have no control over the actions of the driver, yet could now find themselves vicariously liable for those events if there were an accident. This turns current trucking liability on its head and also flies in the face of federal legislation known as the Graves Amendment, which protects owners of trailers from this exact situation. So with clarifying language to ensure that the tractor and trailer will continue to be treated as one motor vehicle, we would have no concerns about this legislation. However, in its current form, we believe it could expose the trucking industry to unnecessary litigation, raising operating costs for the industry and ultimately consumers. Just to add a little bit to the discussion that's taken place so far, this V case was a new case before the plaintiffs hadn't tried to argue to get this double coverage against the trailer owner. So that's a new twist in terms of what people are arguing for. And so we think that they were stymied by having this definition of motor vehicle in 169, but I think then, so the pendulum's one way. I think then by going this route to clarify what happened in 2005, that shifts the pendulum the other way, because historically it's been on the person operating that vehicle, which is the tractor driver, that has the liability, and that's what I understand to be historically case law, federal regulations, all those sorts of things.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. And I guess I'm familiar with the No-Fault Act enough to know that there generally is there's language in the Act that sets out priorities for coverage. And so I'm a little bit unsure why you would think that this would add some additional responsibilities that would not, you know, that would change those priorities. It seems like, and we have lots of situations where you have additional supplemental insurance if you get to that level of damages, you know, where there's a priority that the first order of policy, the first policy that's going to be held responsible is responsible, but then if you say that's $50,000 and you have $1 million worth of coverage, then it provides for orders of priority for subsequent policies that would come into play.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like I don't know what would have changed simply by putting the definition back to the way it was before, why this would be any different as far as changing what I would assume was the law before this technical blip thing happened, where you would have had an add-on liability before and you'd have it back again now, but only if it first exhausted that first insurance policy. I mean, I don't know why. Can you point to some language or some specific reason why that wouldn't be the case? Or am I misstating something?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I have to apologize because I'm not as familiar with the no-fault statute and how it lays out those priorities, but this has been a new world for me, and I've been educated very quickly on this issue from folks that live and breathe this every day. But as I understand it, the onus and the responsibility falls on the motor carrier who's operating the tractor and pulling that trailer, not on the trailer owner. So this, I'm not sure if I'm completely answering your question, but it would open the door then to liability where the trailer owners did not have it before. And before 2005, we weren't seeing these sort of cases being litigated. So these are a new kind of case being litigated since that time.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I think what I just said has always been very well-settled law. And I guess I'm just wondering from Mr. Carlson if that is an accurate representation of what I said, because it seems to me that, you know, we don't want to not correct an inadvertent mistake simply because someone says we're afraid. If we can't point to the language and be able to explain exactly why this would somehow change things.
Senator Backus. I mean.
Promotion, no. May I respond quickly first before Senator Carlson? Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think the difference is between the auto coverage insurance versus the liability insurance, and they're two different insurances. So I think under no fault what you're saying is accurate, but this would bring in potentially the liability coverage on the trailers, which doesn't fall under the no-fault law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, you just hit it on the head, and your accurate reflection of the law is stated in the case that's before you. And, you know, reading from page 8, you know, this is according to the trucking firm. Any question as to the existence, extent, or priority of insurance coverage that may be available to the trucking firms or any other party are not at issue until there has been a judgment. You settle that out after the fact. And the priority of coverage and the extent of coverage. This issue, which the trucking companies argued to the court, goes to liability. It does not go to coverage. And I think it's disingenuous to now come here and argue it's a coverage issue when you argue in court on page 5 that it's a legal liability issue. It is not a coverage. And they say, instead of just saying it differently, instead the legislature moved the Safety Responsibility Act in 2005 to Chapter 169, presumptively making it subject to the definitions of motor vehicle in that chapter. You didn't see these cases before, I contend, because the defense was the trucking firms were never able ever to raise this as an issue. It was never an opportunity for them to say, we're not a motor vehicle under the definition. And now, because of this renumbering, 169 says a motor vehicle doesn't include a trailer, we're out. That's just what happened. And it's confusing, but if you ask everybody, what is the definition that is used for the Safety Responsibility Act prior to the 2005 amendment, everyone I've talked to, including Amber Backus and her lawyers, say that the definition that is used is 65B43 subdivision 2. That's been the case since 1945, affirmed in the Gala decision in 1992, and no one can tell me that that is not the definition that is used for the purposes of the Safety Responsibility Act.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, then, Ms. Backus, are you saying then that you don't believe that trailers should have liability insurance then?
Ms. Backus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, no, that's not what I'm saying. I believe they should have liability insurance, and they are required to have liability insurance, and they do have liability insurance because there are things that can go wrong with the trailer, and the owners of the trailer should be responsible for that. But in these instances, and in this provision of law, we're talking about the driver being the agent of the owner, and now does that extend to the owner of the trailer who doesn't have control over that driver and his actions?
Senator Dahl.
But thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Backus, I might argue that the trailer might have something to do with the actions of the driver. I believe that that this should stay as one unit. I believe that the intent of the 1945 law is the right way to go, and they are not separate units. They should be treated as one unit.
Ms. Backus.
And Mr. Chair, and Senator Senator Dahl, excuse me, we believe they should be treated as one unit as well, and we would like language to clarify that. That would help give us some comfort moving forward. But we think this does open it up that they could potentially be treated separately. So we would be open to having language confirming that they are treated as one motor vehicle. So that doesn't open it up to the potential ability to have double coverage.
Mr. Chairman and members,
Senator Scogin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Betzel or maybe Mr. Carlson, I mean, can we have a definition in here about motor vehicle? I mean, I know there's a reference of what a motor vehicle is, but can we we provide some comfort language?
Mr. Chairman and members, I attached, distributed a memo to the committee, which included the definitions in 169 and 65B. Although we think the cross-reference is adequate, a motor vehicle in 65B is on the last page of that memo and includes every vehicle except a motorcycle for use. I'm just reading along here. And includes a trailer with one or more wheels when the trailer is connected or being towed by a motor vehicle. That is the definition right now in 65B. When I met with the reviser to correct this instruction to them to renumber this, this is the correction that the reviser has suggested to us, and I really haven't seen anyone yet that has told me that it is not the right reference. Even though they think it may have a different consequence or we'd like it to be different, no one has said that this is not the right reference that is currently, prior to 2005, was being used as the definition of a motor vehicle for the Safety Responsibility Act.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
As I was wrestling with some of the aspects of this, and I met with some folks in my office yesterday, I thought, well, if maybe we could just pull this new section out of 169 that was renumbered into there. We can't send it to 170 because there's nothing left in 170. I thought, well, couldn't we just, say, move it over to the no-fault law and just take care of it there because this adopts it. The problem there is that the 65B no-fault also has a definition of motor vehicle, which includes a vehicle other than a motorcycle. So if you try to cross-references or pull it into that other, the no-fault section, now you're dealing, you know, maybe you take care of the trailers, but now you're dealing with motorcycles. And because you got two different conflicting definitions of what a motor vehicle is. So it isn't quite as simple as just cross-referencing it into there. And so, as I say, this one is going to be contentious. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize to Senator Betzel that I wasn't here earlier to hear some of this. It seems to me that some of the discussion is getting to what I would consider probably more appropriate for judiciary. It's here because it has the 65B mm-hmm. reference, and but we're talking about liability, and I think that I don't know. Has judiciary requested?
Yes, they have.
the bill, then if members, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to judiciary.
As amended.
You amended it.
It was not amended.
Never
mind.
Okay. I withdraw the as amended.
Senator Olson.
And Mr. Chair, I would urge the committee to support that motion, also with the understanding that if it's a question of some comfort language that would clarify the intent, that I'm sure Senator Scheid, Senator Betzold, and I, who are all on judiciary, would be happy to continue to look at whatever language the trucking industry might suggest, if that would be helpful.
And Mr. Chairman and members, Carlson, we have offered and continue to offer to address any amendments that simply get the law back to where it was in 2005, and we're happy to do that.
I think I've chaired more committees than anything.
Thank you. That's good. And I think Senator Scogin's point, too, I think that would be good if we continue to work on this, and obviously we want to give the truckers some comfort, too. But back to the Scheid motion that Senate File 251 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Just a final comment. Beware of the data practices bill.
Senator Anderson,
I don't know if they want to do anything. We'll let their staff figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk and just the subject.
It's 5-4.
Sure.
Talk a
more. Senator Anderson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be back in your committee. I have before you, members, Senate File 298, and I know we're under some time constraints, so I'll try to move along. Madam Chair, members, this bill is an idea that was brought to me by a constituent, Mr. Martinson, who's here with us today, and he brought this issue to my attention last winter, and we introduced the bill but didn't have an opportunity to move forward until this year. And we're bringing it to your attention and asking for some help here for a consumer protection issue. And I'll let Greg Martinson tell the story of what happened to him and his family, but I'll tell you briefly that what the bill does by way of introduction. It relates to lost or stolen cell phones. And what we did was, at Mr. Martinson's suggestion, is model the bill after our credit card law that's been on the books for many, many years, that basically says that if you lose your phone or it's stolen and as a credit card, that your liability for any charges that you have not authorized would be capped at $50. And that would be in the event that you don't realize it's lost or stolen. That's the Section 1, that your liability is limited as long as you report this that the charges are unauthorized after you get your bill. And so we say in here that within 60 days of receipt of the bill, you have to call the company, and at that time your liability would be limited if the charges are unauthorized. And the second section, or subdivision 2, would say that as soon as you call and report it lost or stolen, then you wouldn't be liable for charges that were incurred after that time. And as I said, Mr. Stang drafted this? Yes. No. Anyway, whatever. It's done. If you look at the credit card law 325G.04, which it was originally passed in 1969, it uses almost identical language for most of the bills. So that's the theory that we're proceeding on, that this makes sense and that it's worked very well in the credit card arena. Why don't I let Mr. Martinson tell a story, and then I'll just give you a little bit more information about why we think that this is an appropriate bill to move forward with at this time. So with that, I'll introduce Mr. Martinson. Martinson.
Are you Greg Martinson?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Greg Martinson. I'm a media specialist at Roseville Area High School.
Welcome here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is an unusual and new experience for me, so you'll have to bear with me here. I'm a little nervous with the experience here. I'm not standing behind the industry.
We're used to unusual experiences, but you're very welcome here, and your kind of testimony is the thing that we listen to and really value. So thank you for coming.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. This is not a source of great pride in my family. Let me begin with this. My son went to Valley Fair a couple of years ago. During the summer, had a great experience. I'm quite proud of my son. He's a little, we use the expression la-la in describing my son. He can very easily lose himself in whatever is going on at the moment. He went to Valley Fair, had a great time, returned from Valley Fair. He had a cell phone with him. We never checked to see whether he had returned with his cell phone. So again, this is not a source of great pride in my family. but it was only until the end of that month that we noticed that his cell phone, that we were convinced that his cell phone had been missing. And the way we discovered that as a fact was receiving our cell phone bill after, you know, that for that month, and it was $800. So we called the cellular phone company, and by the time we had called our cell phone company, the charges had in the process of reading the bill to making the phone call, the mail process, the charges had risen to $1,200. There were calls to Indonesia. There were calls to Pakistan. They were unusual. They were unusual calls. My son doesn't know anybody in Indonesia or Pakistan, It was with a great deal of surprise that we called T-Mobile, our cell phone provider, and we were told that it was very unfortunate. They would do the best they could. Actually, they were very helpful, but they also said that basically we would have to be responsible for it and that they would provide a method for us to pay back this bill. And I understand there's a certain amount of liability on our part in not, you know, following up on our son in the process. But as I you know, went through that, we discovered that there was no limit into the amount that an individual consumer could be responsible for if they lose a cell phone. And between the time of losing that cell phone and notifying the cellular phone provider, in my job as a media specialist at a high school of 2,200 kids, I took the opportunity the other day to speak to our police liaison officer. And he reports that for every average week, he deals with 5 to 10 missing cell phone items for each young person. You know, 5 or 10 missing cell phones in the high school in any week. And most of those are not recovered. Many of those result in identity theft. You can use your cell phone for a number of purposes. I'm sure you all know that. It's very interesting walking around here because everyone is glued to their cell phone. Everyone is doing a text message. The cell phone has become much more than just a form of communications. It in many ways can be used for providing goods and services that are well beyond just making telephone calls. You can use it to download ringtones. So the potential charges are great. And in many ways, the distinction between a cell phone and a credit card are becoming less and less the case. And so, you know, in thinking through that situation, I wrote to Senator Anderson a couple of years ago and asked if there would be some system in place for dealing with it in the same way that credit cards are regulated.
So, thank you, Mr. Martinson. Did you not receive any kind of... every once in a while I hear about this kind of thing happening, mm-hmm. and that, or sometimes it's just the teenager, for example, themselves making lots of calls, and that sometimes companies are understanding with the first, you know, offense, if you will, and make some kind of a settlement with people or... I don't know. It seems to me I've heard that in other conversations. Did they not make any kind of adjustment?
Chairman, I could definitely say that our cellular phone provider did ultimately, after several phone calls, and we were pretty, it became very emotional, you know, dealing with a $1,200 bill. Ultimately, they did help us.
You aren't the first one, Mr. Martinson.
Right. Yes,
the legislature itself had a bill that was substantially higher than that.
I remember the situation. I was living in Wilmer at the time,
you know,
I can remember that.
So it does happen, and
we negotiated it down to a $300 charge. So I'm not here to cast aspersions on our cell phone providers, but we did have to throw ourselves in the mercy of the cell phone provider to provide assistance for us.
I was going to ask, thank you. I was going to ask Senator Anderson, have you explored whether or not this kind of thing is covered in people's contracts or?
Madam Chair, we've explored that, yeah, and we do have, we did look at a lot of contracts from the major companies, and we don't see any limits on liability, but what we've seen is, and I don't want to, if I misspeak, I'm sure the companies will correct me, that what they tell me that they do is that they investigate and decide whether the charges are authorized or not. And I did hear, you know, I did meet with as many of the company representatives this week as I was able to, and they all said that they, you know, if they're not authorized charges, they take them off. So what I tried to do was to find out, you know, is this the only time this has ever happened? And so we did some research, and we tried to find out how commonly this problem is reported. And what we found, well, there's a few handouts that are just a few of the articles that I've seen in the media. We have an email from someone who might be your constituent, Madam Chair, from Brooklyn Park, who emailed me and said she couldn't come today because she was working. I should mention Mr. Martinson took time off work to be here today. And she had a similar problem. We did find that around the country, there's just a whole slew of these stories that have occurred, and some of them have been really extreme, and they're all different companies. So it's not about one company. It's about, this is a very common problem that, for example, the woman from Brooklyn Park said, the daughter thought the phone was broken, so she didn't report that it was lost. And then apparently it was stolen, and she had to pay $500 for text message charges. Another one, and this is in your handout, in California, she had her cell phone stolen while she was out of the country on vacation. She called her company when she returned. She was off the grid, apparently, and was told there were no charges on the phone. And later found that there were over $1,000 in charges. The company credited her account for the charges, but still demanded $735 in roaming charges. There's a number of examples where people found that the companies were demanding they pay large amounts of money, but they contacted the media, and then the charges were removed. There was one that was $16,000. In charges.
Senator Anderson, I see one at $26,000. That's more than my first house. So yeah. That's kind of shocking.
Yeah.
Senator Marty has a question.
A number of examples.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, credit card companies right now, I know when we travel, even just out of state sometimes, we'll get message on our home machine, call us right away, our fraud department, because we see some unusual charges on your account because they're not in Minnesota. Do we expect, I assume the cell phone companies right now don't do any checking to find out right now. Do we expect they might do some checking if this passes? Or?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
we talked about that. I think you really have to ask the companies what they do what their policies are on that. We did have some discussion about, how they investigate whether the charges are unauthorized, and they do look at your previous billing history, usually. But I'm not sure if they I don't know. I think some of them may contact you. I don't know the answer to that. I guess the companies will have to answer that because we have discussed it, but I don't recall what they said about that. Can I just make a couple other quick points, if I may, Madam Chair, just to
sure,
finish?
Sure, and then Senator Marty wants to follow up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll just...
Senator Marty.
He has to say.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I wanted to find out if I'm understanding subdivision 1 and 2 right. For example, if Senator Scogin had his cell phone stolen And under the first paragraph, if he
the old one?
Yeah, but I don't have it. He took it.
Oh, he stole it.
We have a stolen.
I'm not saying who stole it.
Well, you pointed to him.
I raised two sons. Senator Anderson, you might relate to this. And Mr. Martinson.
Yeah. Boys will be boys.
But right. In subdivision one, if Senator Scogin would not report it stolen until he got a bill that said that the thief had run up $1,000 worth of charges, he would then be responsible for $50 of those charges, plus presumably the regular phone service. But under subdivision two, in effect, if he reported it right away and then the thief ran up a bill after he reported it, then he would be responsible for none of that. Is that the way it would work?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, that's exactly right. But just to elaborate a little bit, yes, and the companies did say clearly that if someone calls and reports it stolen, they cut off the service. Okay. And there's a few stories we heard about people who had to pay even after that, but the companies were pretty clear that they already do this and they wouldn't hold you liable for in that circumstance. In the first, subdivision is really to deal with that situation where you don't know that it's been stolen or lost, you're not sure, you think it's broken, so you don't report it. Whatever it is, if you don't discover it until you get the bill, then we wanted to have some protection. But only, I also want to clarify, only if they're unauthorized. And it's up to the company to really determine whether they're unauthorized charges or not. So if the company feels that even if you call, say you're trying to defraud the company, you call and say, oh, I didn't make this $1,000 worth of calls, then it's up to the company to determine whether you're telling the truth or not. And so if they determine that, if you can't prove that you didn't make them, they could still make you pay for all of it. This just says if they're unauthorized. And under the contracts and the law, that's really up to the companies to determine. And most of the policies that I've seen say that there's a presumption that they're authorized if they're made from your phone. And so, you have to convince the company that they're not authorized to be able to receive this protection. That's what I would say. Under current law, that's my understanding of how it would work. And, okay. Madam Chair, just the other point I just wanted to make, there's that whole preemption issue, and I'm sure that if the companies want to comment, they may argue that, there's a preemption issue when it comes to cell phone regulation. And I just wanted to mention that head on, and I'm sure you've had some discussion about this in the committee in the past. I reviewed the circuit court opinion that came out a couple of years ago, and, I think it's unnecessarily restrictive. Personally, there's a real debate among the circuits about across the country about what's preempted and what's not preempted, and ours is by far the strictest reading of that. But I don't think this is preempted under the Eighth Circuit, because this is about, they said clearly that if it's regulating rates, that's covered by federal law. We can't regulate rates. But we can regulate in the state terms and conditions of a contract. And in the court opinion, I just want to quote one thing from that, and then I'll stop. The court opinion talks about the legislative history of the federal communications law. And they quote the committee discussion in Congress that said this: by terms and conditions, the committee intends to include such matters as customer billing information and practices and billing disputes and other consumer protection matters. So I think this is very clearly within that category that Congress was talking about should be within states' rights to regulate. So, and the last comment I wanted to make is, as parents, this is a tough issue for parents, because if you let your children have cell phones, you run these kind of risks sometimes because they may not be completely responsible in handling them. On the other hand, in today's world, it's the best way to ensure security with your children. And so it's really, there's a lot of reasons why a parent wants their child to have a cell phone, so they can call them in case they need them or they need to get picked up. And so it puts parents in a difficult position where they're trying to do what's right and be responsible for their children. But if there's something that goes wrong, if the cell phone gets stolen, they could be on the hook for lots and lots of money. And that doesn't seem fair to me.
Okay, thank you, Senator Anderson. I see that there are some people, Mr. Bass from AT&T and Mr. McDermott from Verizon, if you want to come up. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Gerlach
could
has a question.
Can I ask my question first before we do that?
Yes, of course.
I just wanted, if I could, Ms. Warren, just you mentioned really at the quick at the end of your testimony that you originally had the $1,200 bill, but then you said you got him down to the $300. That's what you settled on after you discussed everything with him, and is that correct?
Yes,
Mr. Martinson.
Yes, Madam Chairman. And
so then, maybe you could tell me. Then, were you satisfied with the result of that? I mean, you negotiated it out. You said this is what we should pay, or whatever it was.
Madam Chair, that's when he emailed me and said, "I think we should change the law."
So you were not satisfied with the
I wouldn't say I was satisfied. I'm certainly less. I was certainly more satisfied than having to work through a $1,200 bill. I mean, it was unauthorized charges, not services that I received.
And Madam Chair, he
yes.
did. That's another point, Mr. Mr. Martinson mentioned that he said he didn't. There was no dispute with his company about whether the charges were unauthorized. They agreed with they weren't authorized. The question was, did he have to pay them anyway? And so that's when he suggested that we should have some kind of a cap on liability. One more thing. I have some ideas for amendments that would be compromises. I'm very open if we can try to accommodate concerns if the 60 days is too long, if we want to make other accommodations. I have some ideas, but we could present
okay.
that at the end if you'd prefer.
Well, yes. And members, I would like us to deal with Senator Anderson's bill this afternoon because you do have other stops along the way, and I think Senator Prettner-Solon's committee probably would be seeing us next.
Yes.
So we're going to, you know, try to do that. Senator Metzen probably wants us to be up there at 2:30, but Senator Metzen, you may have to tell them we're still voting. I just want to get this done. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prettner-Solon.
We do have 3 o'clock meetings, too.
Yeah, we're
well,
Madam Chair, we're in session at 2:30, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, if
okay.
Senator Vandeveer.
One quick question, Mr. How long was the phone missing before you called it?
Mr. Martinson.
Madam Chairman, Senator Vandeveer, I think it was about 3 weeks. We were uncertain. There was a period of time where we were unclear about whether the phone was missing or not. Like I said, this is not something that I'm coming to you with great pride about.
Well, if you don't mind me
Senator
saying,
Anderson.
I think you said in your email you thought it might have been lost in your son's messy room.
Right.
So I'm not trying to embarrass. His son wanted to come, but he was a little too shy to come and tell the story.
Also a source of great pride for him, I'm sure.
But that's just normal. Normal.
None of us can relate to children with messy rooms either.
Did you try calling the number?
So let's have the gentleman come up and. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We did a rock, paper, scissors, and Mr. Bass is going to go first.
Okay. Mr. Bass?
Thank you, Chairman Scheid and members of the committee. I am Bob Bass, and I'm the president for AT&T here in Minnesota. And I'm here to speak to you today on, obviously, Senate File 298. We appreciate the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. As Senator Anderson mentioned, we met with her earlier this week to discuss the bill. We wanted to raise some concerns and talk with her. She asked, and we've been trying since that meeting to find some language that would be acceptable. We met with her on Tuesday, and we've had a lot of discussions among the industry and other carriers to find something. But for the sake of today's hearing, though, I want to quickly cover some of the issues we raised with Senator Anderson. First of all, obviously, we applaud the efforts of Senator Anderson and the other co-sponsors in working to provide protections for wireless consumers. However, I would respectfully submit from AT&T that this legislation is not necessary and that our current policies and practices provide ample protections for customers. And it's in our best interest that we handle the issues of lost or stolen phones or if there are unauthorized charges on our customers' bills. And I believe that the practices that I'll talk about, obviously we have a representative from Verizon, but I think that these policies and practices are pretty uniform across the industries. And one thing, I just casually glanced at some of those articles where you saw some of those outrageous bills, and I noticed in the headline the date is 2005, just as a note. AT&T takes the issues of lost or stolen phones very seriously. Our policies are if you, as one of our customers, have your phone lost or stolen, we ask that you contact us via our customer service center or you contact us via the internet. We will immediately suspend and deactivate that phone. We will also notify you that you are no longer liable for any subsequent charges to that device. We will ask you that you then look at your bill when it comes, and if there is anything on there that doesn't look right, to bring it to our attention. And we will go through your bill, particularly around the time when, because, you know, let's be honest, you know, with the gentleman from Roseville and his story, you know, they weren't quite sure. So if you can, you know, we ask our customers, you know, come to us, we'll work with you. We're not in, you know, one of the things that's happened with our industry is it's become so darn competitive that one of the ways we differentiate ourselves is through customer service. And a lost or stolen cell phone or an unauthorized charge is something we take very seriously. Because if you're one of our customers and you do not have a positive experience, especially with local number portability, you can take that number and go to another carrier. Regarding the issue of unauthorized charges, it is our policy, and we again ask our customers to look at their bills every month. We ask them to look at their bill, and if you see something that doesn't look right, to notify us. And we allow our customers up to 100 days from the receipt of a bill to bring a disputed charge to us. And we will sit down and go through those issues one by one on those bills. If the customer is not satisfied with resolution of their particular disputed charge, we offer arbitration for those customers so that they can go through and that can be heard. We think that is a very broad coverage and provides consumers with a lot of protection in this particular case.
Mr. Bass, do those disputed charges, do they generally hinge on the phone being lost or stolen?
You know, I went back through, since many people in here have gone through the last couple of years of issues and complaints, and out of the complaints that we receive as a company, lost or stolen phones are probably one of the fewest things that we get. We don't want to upset customers, and I know err is the wrong word, but we err on the side of the customer. We're very liberal in how we look at unauthorized charges. I think Senator Anderson mentioned that we do go back and we look at calling patterns because we can see the top 10, top 20, top 30, top 40 type of calls that you make and the numbers and those sorts of things. But again, when you think about the man hours it takes to go through disputed charges and those kind of things, we side on the customer, again, for a number of reasons. One, that if they don't like the experience they have with us, they're going to move on to somebody else.
Mr. Bass, is there a possibility, I mean, I don't know that you would want this for everybody, but that where you could have to put in a code before you use the phone, do they ever do that?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, and it was one of the things I was going to bring up. Another protection consumers have is that almost every handheld device has the ability to be password protected. I know my device, it goes out after a minute, and it's just a protection that I have. You still have the ability to make 911 calls when it's password protected. So if somebody stole your phone and saw a horrific act and needed, they can still call 911 from that phone. But they couldn't call the Philippines, as was in the gentleman's story earlier. But almost every device and every manufacturer makes a device that can be password protected. So the times vary anywhere from a minute to 5 minutes to 15 minutes. So, yes, there is the ability for password protection.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bass, is the I'm just thinking of, you know, other options other than legislation and some of these things, but is there any discussion in the industry that, like credit cards have credit limits, if I have a phone for a, and I'm going to give it to my teenager, where you can say, you know, there's a $200 limit. After you hit a $200 billing limit, your computers, I imagine the technology would exist, would end the ability to make any more calls on that unless you up the limit or something like that. And that would that not offer a protection that you can handle on your own?
Well, on our
Madam
Chair, through you to Senator Gerlach. On prepaid phones, there is. You're only going to be able to go to a set dollar amount. I haven't heard any discussions, and I'll defer to Mr. McDermott from Verizon, from Verizon's perspective, but I haven't seen any discussions on placing a limit on that.
Mr. McDermott.
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome.
I have some brief comments, if you would mind, and then I know you're sensitive to floor action, so I'll be brief. My name is Michael McDermott. I'm the Executive Director of State Public Policy for Verizon Wireless. In the past year, I'd like to talk about the bill briefly, but I'd like to also give you an update about Verizon Wireless's activities in the state over the last year. And I think it's a very positive story. We've successfully acquired two wireless entities servicing Minnesotans, Rural Cellular Corporation, known as RCC, and Alltel Wireless. The RCC conversion to the wireless brand and upgrades to the former RCC network are being handled right now and are almost completed. We also expect to have the Alltel properties brought to our 3G standard by third quarter of this year. We now serve 83 million customers nationally. And in Minnesota, we are an undeniable economic engine, having invested $86 million in 2008 alone to upgrade our network to bring our capital investment over the last 8 years to over $500 million. We also are pleased to announce that in just the past few months, Minneapolis, Minnesota was one of six test markets in the world, one of two in the United States, where we tested our 4G platform in a trial to determine which infrastructure manufacturers will be using to build our state-of-the-art 4G platform beginning in late 2009, early 2010. Lastly, we spend an additional $500 million a year with Minnesota-based companies like 3M and Target, as well as an infrastructure firm like KGP, a woman-owned enterprise in Faribault. Regarding the bill, Madam Chair, while it is well-intended, we feel strongly that the bill is not necessary. Of the complaints that are sent to us from public utility commissions, Better Business Bureaus, attorneys general's offices, and offices such as yours, we have not seen the issue of lost or stolen phone charges as a major problem. This is not to suggest that there aren't lost or stolen phones. It's just that our policy on the issue is customer friendly and usually results in a resolution to the customer's satisfaction. In fact, of the complaints we process from the Minnesota Attorney General's office, the issue of lost or stolen phone charges doesn't even rank. We have a very liberal policy, as Mr. Bass said, as of AT&T, that encourages customers to contact us immediately when they are aware that their phone had been lost or stolen. And our contract reads as follows. If your wireless phone is lost or stolen, it is very important that you notify us immediately for your own protection so that we can suspend your service to prevent further usage. If your bill shows charges to your phone after the loss but before you reported it and you want a credit for those charges, we will investigate your account activity. You do not have to pay the charges you dispute while they are being investigated to determine whether the charges resulted from usage by someone not authorized to use the phone. Further, if we haven't given you a courtesy suspension of reoccurring monthly fees within the prior year, we will give you one for 30 days or until you replace or recover your wireless phone, whichever comes first. You may need to provide further information regarding the theft or loss if we ask for it. That's actually verbatim from our contract. And finally, while the intent of the bill is addressed through the sheer nature of the competitive marketplace, Verizon Wireless strongly believes that this bill, as written, would be preempted by federal law dealing with the regulation of wireless service and rates at the state level. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Well, Mr. McDermott, then, I mean, it sounds like from what both you and Mr. Bass have said and other people that I've spoken with concerning the issue that they're already kind of dealing with this on a company-by-company, customer-by-customer basis. So it isn't so much that the language of the bill would inconvenience you or hurt business is it just kind of the principle that we shouldn't muck around in it, or, you know?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, one that I hadn't anticipated. But I think the issue of the preemption is a real one. It's not the issue of doing what's right by the consumer. We have a good faith belief that when a consumer calls us and says they've lost their phone, we're out of the country. I mean, we know that each case is unique. Even though we have 83 million customers, we handle each complaint as unique. But the issue of codifying a policy in a state like Minnesota or elsewhere, especially one that we think goes too far on the preemption issue, is one that is alarming to us on that aspect.
Mr. McDermott, do you know if any other state has acted to treat? I thought I saw something in here that said California was treating this situation like they treat credit card. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'd like to defer to Mr. Bass.
Madam Chair, what California did is California went to each of the, and this is in 2007, a deputy AG in California went to all of the wireless providers and attempted to apply a statute which dealt with unauthorized charges for landline providers in California. That particular attorney general came to, at that time, lucky us, we were the first one on the list. They must have done it alphabetically.
Yes.
They brought some, at that time, I'll be honest, we had some problems where people did not, we didn't handle those the way we should have. As a result of what we ended up doing with the attorney general in California, which is now in our contract and in our service, in our terms of service. We then said that's where the policy of we will, once you notify us, you're no longer liable for charges. Subsequent charges moving forward, contact your provider over unauthorized charges, all of those things that I think have become pretty much the standard throughout the industry.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess I have to say that the idea, I mean, if this is good consumer protection public policy, then having it in statute, to me, is a good idea. And I appreciate the testimony of these gentlemen, but I do have to say that it sounds like there are some loopholes where, for example, you know, with the gentleman from AT&T saying you're only not liable after you've reported this to us, well, when you have your kids using cell phones, I mean, I don't know how many people check in every single day with their kids to see if they've still got the same property in their backpack that they had the day before. But honestly, the kids are we know that they're not so responsible that they're going to even notice that something is missing necessarily right away, much less run right to you and bring it to your attention. So it seems to me that if the issue is that, you know, if there is, in fact, a theft and an unauthorized use, and we don't think that customers should be responsible for those unauthorized uses within some reasonable period of time, that putting it in law to say that seems to me to be a reasonable consumer protection action to take. And again, with no disrespect intended, but in dealing with cell phone issues now over the last year and a half or so, it seems to me like, and understandably, I'm sure the industry does not want regulations, period. Some reasonable balance between some consumer protection and things that are not onerous from the cell phones, especially if they're saying that this is kind of their intent anyway, that makes sense to me.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Anderson, do you want to? I don't know if anybody else on the committee had any questions of these gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson, would any amendment you have be appropriate in this committee, or is it something?
Madam Chair, just a couple of ideas. And let's see. I heard, you know, the one question is whether the 60 days to report is too long. And I don't know. I guess I haven't heard the company say We heard from Mr. Bass that AT&T allows you 100 days to dispute charges, so I don't know what's the reasonable amount. I'm open on that. I don't have an amendment drafted on that. The other issue that came up in our discussion yesterday was about whether, if you don't have a billing history, if you're a brand new customer, if that creates a problem, because then how do you determine if it's an unauthorized use? And so do we have Ms. Sliwa maybe drafted an amendment on that, or Mr. Stang, I'm not sure. That would, you know, help the companies in that regard to say that if you're a new customer, if you don't have any billing history, I don't think this would apply. That's
Senator Olson, would you be interested in offering that amendment? It says that if the customer has less than 30 days service history, then this does not apply. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess if the committee thinks that's a reasonable compromise, but I would think that either way the customer is still going to have to show something is unauthorized. And maybe if you're within that 30 days, you'd have to show, well, gee, these calls all came from California and I haven't left the state of Minnesota or something, you know. But if I don't know. I don't have any strong feelings about it one way or the other.
Madam Chair, just a thought. Senator Scogin. I would think in the event of an actual theft, in about 3 days, day and a half maybe, the phone's dead. These people aren't running around with a bunch of chargers keeping them going. I mean, it should go pretty fast, I would think. And it's a little hard to compare it to credit card because with a credit card unauthorization, you can actually go back and recoup property and tell a store that you didn't check for the signature and you didn't get proper ID and now you have a stolen TV and we're going to credit this account. You can't uncall the calls. So I think we got to shorten that. If you want a positive vote from me, that date, those days have to be shortened way up from me. And I know you want to move it today, but we're going to have to do something to it. Okay. It's not
well,
good.
No, Senator Scogin, that's fair enough. No, that's fair enough. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I actually don't support this amendment, but I think it's shortening up the time from when somebody reports it's more like 20 days or 30 days would be better. Because I think actually once you get the bill and you see, hey, I mean, I can see it, you losing it. I lost mine the other day, and I knew it was somewhere around.
Senator Scogin had it.
Senator Scogin's been having trouble with his phone, I guess.
If anybody sees it. It's like 30 years old. It's pretty easy to see in this group.
But Madam Chair, I guess I would. I think once you don't know necessarily right away that it, whether it's lost or stolen, and but once you get the bill and it says, hey, this they've been calling Timbuktu a lot, you know, and so I think 20 days would be 20 days from the receipt of the bill would be much more appropriate. So I'm going to move. Unless somebody's moved the other amendment, I'll move.
No, they haven't.
Delete 60 on line 10 and insert 20.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I think that's a fine compromise because I think that's a reasonable amount of time for most reasonable people to open their bill, and if it's something really egregious or unauthorized, you would know right away when you look at it.
On that amendment, Senator Vandeveer, did you? No. All those in favor of the Marty amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'll try moving the bill. I move that Senate
it's file. Real heavy, Senator Marty. I don't know if you can do this.
Senate file 298 be recommended pass as amended. Be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on
Energy and Telecom.
Energy, utilities, and other stuff.
And I yeah, Senator Marty's motion is that Senate file 298 as amended be recommended to pass. And we referred to energy, utilities, technology, and communications. Any discussion, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. Appreciate it.
Members, I know that Senator Metzen wants us there, but we do have on Tuesday we're hearing Senator Bach's school employee health plan, and Senator Dibble has health insurance coverage plan. Senator Dahl has is yours about
service
yours is about service co-ops and local government, am I correct? And Senator Latz, the bill for the Attorney General's Consumer Complaint Database, and the meeting adjourned.